Today is Wednesday, April 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. For the coronavirus outbreak, things may get worse before they get better.
In the next several days to a week or so, we're going to continue to see things go up. We cannot be discouraged by that, because the mitigation is actually working and will work.
Plus, Australia tells cruise ships to go home.
But the operator of the most well-known vessel, the Ruby Princess, says the government in Canberra needs to adopt a humanitarian approach.
Those stories and more are next. As his administration provides sobering projections of just how deadly the coronavirus pandemic may be in the United States, President Donald Trump is urging Americans to get ready. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani explains.
This is going to be a very bad 2 and maybe even 3 weeks.
Hell of a bad, as the president put it earlier, with the White House projecting between 100,000 and 240,000 people could die, even if Americans follow social distancing guidelines to stem the spread.
When you see 100,000 people, that's at a minimum number.
The president says everybody needs to ramp up social distancing.
It's a matter of life and death.
He calls them sobering numbers, but Tony Fauci disagrees.
We don't accept that number, that's what it's going to be.
Saying the nation should be prepared for that death toll, but can help it be far lower by mitigating the virus's spread.
We are really convinced that mitigation is going to be doing the trick for us.
And already is to a degree, though he acknowledges it's hard to quantify given the daily jump in positive cases and deaths. Fauci says the goal now is to keep areas largely spared from the pandemic so far to avoid seeing their own spikes. Sagar Magani, Washington.
A John Hopkins tally of confirmed coronavirus cases puts the global number at just under 870,000, with more than 42,000 deaths. The United States has the most cases in the world, with over 100,000 more than China, where the pandemic originated. Japan is also struggling to hold the line against the coronavirus and is on the brink of a crisis, with medical experts particularly worried about preparations in Tokyo. Officials raise the prospect of emergency lockdowns. Other governments have locked down cities, regions, and even their entire nations to try and stop the virus from spreading. One of the latest nations to put in place a 2-week ban on all but essential activities is Vietnam. Last week, New Zealand shut down restaurants, bars, offices, and schools. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said Wednesday it is too early to tell how much those measures have helped, and she advocated more testing to track down infections and to stop new transmissions. One of the most vulnerable groups to the infection is older individuals with underlying health conditions. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi spoke with Dr. Talal Nsuli, clinical professor of immunology at Georgetown University, about why this group is susceptible.
It's important to know that after a certain age, our immune system is not as effective as when we are young. So the white cells, the chemicals in the white cells, some of them called cytokines, that have a killing effect on microbes, we have some reduction in the activity of these enzymes and these chemicals. Therefore, at a certain age, our defense goes down due to the aging factor, which is totally normal in one hand. In another hand, if we do have also some additional factors that are risk factors, such as diabetes and other type of medical conditions. Now, let's talk about diabetes. We know that diabetes, that it's not well controlled. Very important. If the diabetes is well controlled, usually the chances are not that significantly increased. There is still some risk involved. Why? Because even if the blood sugar is well controlled, when you get an infection, the infection causes the diabetes to go out of control. So what happens when the diabetes is not stabilized? The different parts of the immune system will no longer function appropriately. There is a delay in production of chemicals that kill the microorganism. There is a reduction in phagocytosis, which means the phenomenon by which the white cells can ingest a virus and destroy the virus. There is a reduction in the complement system functioning. Complement system is a part of the immune system, and this area of the immune system also will be deficient in producing enough complement in order to do the appropriate job and to control the infection. And number two, we do have also an increase in infection due to the fact that people with diabetes, they have an increase in atherosclerosis, which means that their blood vessels are not always widely open. So there is a buildup of material in the wall of these blood vessels, and this reduces the diameter and the blood circulation, and that's why people can have heart attacks, and that's why people sometimes can have decrease in airflow due to that, and decrease in airflow facilitate infection, because when blood is not getting appropriately to some areas, therefore the immune cells and the immune elements cannot reach the specific microbe or virus and get rid of it. So collectively, all of the above are important. But most importantly, knowing that the infection by itself can cause a complete disequilibrium in the stability of the diabetes, and then we go in a vicious cycle. So the infection gets worse, the diabetes gets worse, and vice versa. So one has to be careful. However, we don't want to live in fear. We have to tell people that do have diabetes to be sure, more so nowadays, that they are taking their appropriate treatment, their appropriate medication. If they're using insulin, to use the insulin appropriately. Of course, do not overuse anything. Overuse of insulin could be very, very dangerous, can cause very serious life-threatening problems. To use exactly the treatment that their provider gave them, and to check their blood sugar on a regular basis. And if they notice that the blood sugar is not well controlled, to call their endocrinologist, to call their primary care, to call their physician who has been treating their diabetes, and to tell them, please, I would like to speak with the physicians and would like to adjust my treatment accordingly in order to control my blood sugar, especially nowadays, very important for this coronavirus 19, which is a major disaster, seeing people dying and people having major problems with this virus.
Dr. Talal Nsuli is a professor of immunology at Georgetown University. A new study suggests pangolins, also known as the scaly anteater, may be the missing link in the transmission of the COVID-19 coronavirus between bats and humans. Pangolins are said to be the most trafficked animal species on Earth, and much of the trade in live pangolins is from Africa to Asia. Other studies have suggested humans contracted the virus from bats via snakes. Either way, wildlife trafficking appears to have played a key role in the outbreak. While scientists are continuing their research into the origins of COVID-19, many think the virus may have first infected humans at a market in the Chinese city of Wuhan, where live animals and wild animal parts are sold. VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to Paul Elkin, who is the Sudano-Sahel Region Director for the Wildlife Conservation Society, about the illegal pangolin trade and the global health risks of trafficking any wildlife species.
Pangolin has been quantified to be the most trafficked animal in the world. In Africa, we have four species, three of which are more forested, and then a ground pangolin, which is more in the savannas. Over the years in Africa, we didn't really see too much large-scale hunting and trafficking of pangolin. But in the past 5 years, maybe a bit further, due to the increased demand from Asia, the decrease of pangolin populations in Asia, and also the incursion of Asian and Chinese businesses and industry into Africa, you started seeing this trade in pangolins developing. One hears about ivory being stored in containers and moved in large quantities, but over the past years, we found tons of pangolin scales being stockpiled and then attempted traffic out of Africa towards Asia, in Cameroon, coming out of South Sudan, through Uganda and Kenya, some major seizures. But now, of course, it's taken on a whole nother side to it when we see the research coming out about COVID-19.
Why is there this demand for pangolins in Asia?
Our understanding is folks in Asian markets, they use the scales for medicine, for certain alleged cures, but there's no evidence that there is any medicinal cure. And so this demand for the scales is there, and that's what's driving this intense poaching and trafficking of pangolin. And we've also had cases where pangolin meat is found as well, being trafficked, frozen pangolin meat.
This isn't the first time when wildlife trafficking has been the source of a deadly disease jumping to humans.
This recent article suggesting that the intermediate host and perhaps the transmitter to humans may indeed be pangolins in China from a bat originally. You know, this is bushmeat trade, wild animal trade, directly contributing to the virus jumping from the original host to the intermediate host to humans, which is similar to the SARS outbreak back in 2003, which they said went from horseshoe bats to civets to humans. And in Africa, if we think about investigations into Ebola and it being linked to fruit bats and then fruit bats contaminating fruit and that's eaten by animals and then the animals are eaten by humans and then it gets into the human population. And then even HIV and origins from chimps and mangabeys. So what we're seeing now with the COVID virus 19, once again, how did it get from bats to humans? It's wildlife trade. Frankly speaking, what we simply need to do is just stop the whole thing. These markets need to be stopped. The hunting needs to be stopped. The demand needs to be stopped for the health of the local communities and the global community.
What would your advice be to people who are looking to make money off of this trade because maybe they don't have any other option?
You know, if it's trade, particularly on pangolins, you just flat out say it's illegal, just like with ivory trafficking or a rhino horn trafficking. If you want to obtain a source of revenue, you need to do it legally. Conservation programs around parks. We offer employment to local communities as rangers, as logistics, and all kinds of different levels of ecotourism around parks. That creates jobs. And then people don't need to look for that revenue from illegal wildlife trafficking. And the second part of it is, of course, that it's a health risk, not just pangolin, but all the other wildlife species that people might be commercial hunting. If you want to safeguard human health, whether it's local or national or international, we really got to ban hunting and trade of wildlife. And you need to offer alternative protein opportunities for local people, fishing, livestock, and others, so that they don't have to delve into high-risk practices like bushmeat hunting. Countries that have banned it are at lower risk right now from future transmission of viruses from wildlife to humans.
Paul Elkin is with the Wildlife Conservation Society. Elkin spoke from the Roby to our own Jason Patinkin. And coming up later...
I didn't think it was going to be that amazing, but I mean, the contribution from each member of that orchestra was fantastic.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Australian authorities are telling foreign cruise ships floating off the East Coast to sail home rather than risk flooding the country's hospitals with coronavirus patients. But the operator of the most well-known vessel, the Ruby Princess, says the government in Canberra needs to adopt a humanitarian approach and let the company repatriate its foreign crew. So far, there have been at least 4,763 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Australia, with 20 people having succumbed to the virus. Phil Mercer has that story.
There are 9 cruise ships either docked in the state of New South Wales or waiting off the coast. On board are thousands of international crew members from dozens of countries. Australia is refusing to let them disembark because of fears they could worsen its COVID-19 crisis. New South Wales Police Commissioner Mick Fuller says the vessels must return to their home ports.
You know, they don't pay Australian taxes. They're not considered in terms of someone who we want to bring back on shore to risk the people of New South Wales and also potentially put our health system under enormous pressure by bringing these people back in.
A tenth of Australia's coronavirus cases have come from a single cruise liner, the Bermuda-flagged Ruby Princess. Infected passengers were allowed to disembark in Sydney just over a week ago without proper checks. It's the biggest source of the COVID-19 infection in Australia. The Ruby Princess's owner says it's not safe for it to sail away from Australia while there are crew members who are ill. On board are 1,100 people from more than 50 countries. 6 people have been allowed off the cruise ships for treatment in Australian hospitals. Some have tested positive for COVID-19. 2 pregnant women have also been allowed to disembark. Any vessel that remains in Australian waters without permission can now be subject to heavy fines or even jail terms. Officials have said they will continue to allow the ships access to fuel and food. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The COVID-19 pandemic has stretched to nearly every corner of the planet. I recently spoke with Dr. Jose Vasquez, division chief and professor of medicine of infectious diseases at Augusta University, about why the disease spreads so rapidly and what society needs to learn from this pandemic.
We know that epidemics and pandemics occur every 10 to 20 years. So going back to the SARS in 2002, right? Followed by swine flu, H1N1, Ebola, and now this one. You can see how many we've had just in the past 20 years. It's a significant amount. And the reason for that is obvious, because we are all interconnected by air travel. And everybody's going all over the world. There's no place you can not be in 12 hours, 18 hours, depending on where you're going. So because of that interconnectivity and the fact that that a lot of us are living in major cities, right, one on top of each other, I think that, to me, increases the risk of major epidemics and pandemics because of how close we are. I think you can see it in New York, right, where you have, 10 million people in the area, and they're all riding the subway, they're all riding the bus. Everybody's on top of each other, and you can see what's happened there.
Speaking of New York, I mean, just to have a different kind of picture, you take Seoul, South Korea, the metropolitan area there, 25 million people, their number of cases is significantly less.
So I think they were one of the first ones hit, and they were one of the first ones to react. And I'm sure you know from culture, South Korean culture, Japanese culture, that they really listen to what the government tells them. And I think they started immediate social distancing. I think the government also there ramped up their testing a lot faster than we have here. And they've been able to, to flatten it out a bit significantly, right? Whereas even if you go now to New York, go to the parks, and I'm not sure where you're located, but I mean, the parks still have people everywhere. When the ship came in to New York Harbor, there were a bunch of people side by side there looking at the ship coming in. I mean, what kind of distancing is that? It'd be great if we followed guidelines a little bit better than what we're doing, obviously.
Yeah, so let me, before you let you continue, I mean, so I guess what I hear you saying is that, you know, one of the ways that governments and populations can better address the next epidemic, the next pandemic is to not only ramp up testing as soon as there's a sign of trouble, but also for on the citizen side of things, you know, when health officials issue guidelines, take them seriously and do it immediately.
I mean, absolutely. I think that's been our biggest issue, right, is making sure that we keep distancing. And it works well for a while, and then it kind of waxes and wanes, and it goes up and down. And I just don't think we have great social distancing especially in areas where there's that many people. Number two is I think our government definitely was caught unprepared for this. I think all governments have been caught unprepared, but I think it's a lesson learned that we will have another pandemic in the next 10 years. Probably maybe even sooner than that because of air travel. And we need to have specific plans moving forward, recognizing that this has been obviously the worst one that we've had, you know, for a period of time, although the H1N1 was pretty significant.
Speaking of that mingling and social interacting, and given that, as you mentioned previously, you know, this is very much a global community now where you can travel anywhere within, you know, 18 to 24 hours, depending on how you want to fly. You know, do you foresee additional safety measures being put in place after this coronavirus outbreak subsides a little bit more?
So I don't think we have to live with this on a daily basis once we get out of this pandemic. However, I think we need to have triggers in place or protocols in place to move faster. Not only society, but government has to be nimble with these epidemics. Government has not been nimble with the epidemics. And government, not only federal government, but local governments, right? State officials, city mayors have not been nimble to move quickly with this. And it's something I think that we need to take from here is how quickly we have to move to prevent this intense dissemination of disease.
Jose Vasquez is the division chief and professor of medicine of infectious diseases at Augusta University. Thousands of South Korean workers on U.S. military bases were placed on unpaid leave Wednesday after the United States and South Korea failed to reach a deal on how to split the cost of the U.S. military presence there. Through seven rounds of talks, South Korea has refused the Trump administration's demand to massively increase its contribution toward the approximately 28,500 U.S. troops stationed in South Korea. General Robert Abrams, the top U.S. commander in Korea, called the development an unfortunate day and regrettable. Pepe Diouf, who served as president of the Marseille Soccer Club from 2005 to 2009, died Tuesday after contracting the coronavirus. He was 68. Diouf was a charismatic and popular president who was close to the French club's fans and players. Pepe will forever remain in the hearts of Marseille people and one of the great architects of the club, Marseille team officials wrote under a photo of a Senegal native. While concerts, sporting events, and even church services have been canceled and nations locked down because of the outbreak of the coronavirus, a group of musicians found a way to perform together thanks to technology. VOA's David Byrd tells us how British musician and composer John Miles teamed up with the Antwerp Philharmonic to make music in the age of COVID-19.
Music was my first love. British composer and musician John Miles regularly performs his 1976 hit Music with the Antwerp Philharmonic as part of the Night of the Proms pop and classical music series. But this year, with all such public performances canceled, they had to come up with a new way to play together. Miles told the Associated Press his friend and collaborator, Jan Verrikke, suggested the idea of a virtual performance.
It came, the whole idea, well, the idea came from a phone call that Mr. Verrikke, my Flemish friend, called me just after lockdown, and said, how would you feel about trying this? You know, the orchestra and yourself have played this song so many times live since 1985 or whatever. How about if we get each individual person in the orchestra to record their part, not just the orchestra, but the choir, the rhythm section, and then you do your piece from home, and we put it all together and see what we come up with. And I thought it was kind of a crazy idea, but I thought, well, with the technology we have these days, it can work.
Miles sang and played piano at home in England, while the other musicians and singers performed in their individual places throughout Europe. They all followed a click track to keep time. The tracks were then combined in a studio. John Miles said it was a little awkward with his wife Heidi filming his performance on an iPhone, but it worked out after a couple of takes.
Very, very strange. There was myself and my wife, Heidi, in this room here, and she was operating the iPhone, and I was trying to tell her, well, start with the hands and move up. Well, we only had a couple of times, but she did get it right.
Miles wrote the song in the 1970s, and it has been regularly featured on the Night of the Proms independently organized concert series in Europe. Miles says that he was amazed and proud of the finished product.
I didn't think it was going to be that amazing, but I mean, the contribution from each member of that orchestra was fantastic. Not just the orchestra, the choir, the rhythm section, those guys are all from Holland. Some of the orchestra were recording their parts out in Croatia and all kinds of places, you know. And I heard from Jan, the guy that helped me to put it together, that I think a couple of the orchestra were actually ill at the time, you know, suffering and still recording, which says a lot about this orchestra. They're an amazing bunch of people.
A video of the performance is available on YouTube. It opens with a shot of the empty venue normally used for the performance and then begins with a shot of Miles at his piano. Various musicians and choristers appear in the video playing or singing their parts until the piece concludes with a collage of the players on the final notes. John Miles says he hopes the song, which includes the lyrics, "In this world of trouble, music pulls me through," will be a great help emotionally to a lot of people. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for updated news and world events 24 hours a day. Just point your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.
Hello and welcome to